I'm not a big fan of labeling people as cartoon villains or heroes in the first place. You know, I do believe that the worst amongst us are humans. And I think that turning people into cartoon cutout monsters furthers a lot of problems out there. It alienates people. And, you know, we all know horrible people. We've all done horrible things ourselves, but we're humans. And Action Park, likewise, Action Park itself was a place of immense tragedy, a place of immense sadness, but at the same time, it was a place that some people look back at very fondly.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Culturally Relevant, a podcast about film, television, art, and culture. I'm David Chen, and today I'm going to be speaking with Seth Porges. He's one of the co-directors of a new documentary on HBO Max called Class Action Park, which is a really interesting, at times very fun, at times tragic and sad documentary about a very interesting theme park in New Jersey called Action Park. We'll be talking about it in a little bit. But first, I want to stop and say, how are you all doing out there? How's everyone doing? I hope everyone is doing okay, staying safe. And I'll just offer a few reflections from my life, how I'm doing this week. And I have to just say, you know, I struggle in my daily life with how to feel about things, because I do feel very, very fortunate, very privileged that, you know, I have my basic needs taken care of. I get a roof over my head, 3 squares a day. And I still have a job, you know, and that's a lot more than many people in this country can say right now. And so, like, it's difficult to say anything that might even be considered a complaint. And so I don't want to come off as complaining in any way. But I will say that something that has made me really sad in the last week is just, you know, the last 6-9 months have been really, really wearing on a lot of people. And I think for me, I've seen the things I take joy in life, which weren't that many, be kind of slowly removed from me. You know what I mean? Like, I used to love going to movie theaters. It used to be like one of the things I looked forward to. I could get away from the troubles of the world and kind of immerse myself into movies. I used to go multiple times a week, and, you know, obviously I'm not going to movie theaters right now. Many other things, you know, going to restaurants, things like that, those are all gone too. But even in the COVID era, the one thing I could look forward to every day was going outside and taking a walk, you know, getting a breath of fresh air. And feels like even that is in jeopardy, especially if you're living on the West Coast. The air has been really unhealthy for the last week. And so I've been kind of bunkering down inside with a little air filter next to me as I work from home. So it's been really tough, you know, but again, don't want to complain. So I'm just kind of sharing my own experience, and you know, one of the things I've heard from people is they appreciate me sharing my experience because it helps them to understand that they're not alone in their experience as well. And I actually want to read this email I recently received from somebody writing in to the email at culturallyrelevant@gmail.com. And I'm not going to include any of this person's contact information, like name or identifying information, at his request. But I did find the email to be very powerful. He writes in, quote, "I have a wife and a 5-year-old son. Since June, I've been forced to go back into work by a boss who doesn't really believe in the virus. My work could be done remotely, but what can you do? And as a result, I've been having to self-isolate every day when I get home. I eat outside with my wife and son at a social distance, wear a mask inside my house unless I'm in the bathroom, where I spend almost all my time when I'm at home, and haven't been within 6 feet of my wife and son since June. As you can imagine, this is exceptionally difficult for me. I watch movies to try and cope with some of the loneliness, but I also listen to podcasts, obviously, and your diary episodes, especially the last one, have really been helpful to me. It can be very hard to do what I'm doing when seemingly so many people aren't treating this like a serious issue. My parents eat out at restaurants with my sister and her family. My friends post pictures from the beach on Instagram, and while no one has guilted us for the choices we are making, we haven't felt a lot of support for them either. But my wife, like yours, is immunocompromised, and if she gets it, it could be quite bad. And so to listen to your podcast where you talk about how cautious you're being and are supportive of those who do the same has meant an awful lot to me, more than I could really express, to tell you the truth," end quote. This email goes on, but I just wanted to acknowledge this email because it really broke my heart when I read this email and made me realize that, yeah, there's people out there who are in a situation where they're they are being subjected against their will to like a dangerous situation. They're needing to isolate from their loved ones. And just know that if that describes you, my heart goes out to you as well. My sympathy goes out to you. But also stay strong, you know, keep doing the things that you believe to be the right thing to do. And again, I reiterate that that means like wearing a mask, isolating if necessary, because other people aren't going to do it. We've already seen many examples of that being the case where people are refusing to take these basic precautions and take care of their fellow man and woman. And obviously it's very upsetting and very distressing. But again, stay strong. And thanks to that listener for writing into culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com. But yeah, it's been tough for me, and I've had occasional challenges being creative, making the things that I make. But one of the things that does keep me going is the people that support me on Patreon at patreon.com/DaveChen. I want to thank all of my Chenefactor/executive producer donors this month. I want to thank Steve Austin, Jonathan Sutton, Christopher Yimon, Dan Flanagan, Mario Rivera, Felidia Featherbottom, Jeff Evans, and Mark Warner. All of you and everyone else on the Patreon at patreon.com/DaveChen are making Culturally Relevant possible. So I really, really appreciate you all. And of course, if you want to support me without donating any money to the Patreon, there's many ways to do that. Share this podcast on your social media or leave a review for it on Apple Podcasts. It really does help me to get guests on the show. They see that the show has reviews on Apple Podcasts, and it means they're willing to come on the podcast. So you can actually help improve this podcast by going to Apple Podcasts, leaving a review there for us. All right. Anyway, let's get to this week's conversation. Seth Porges is a science and technology journalist and a former editor at Popular Mechanics. He's the co-director of a new film out on HBO Max right now called Class Action Park, which tells the story of Action Park, a dangerous theme park in New Jersey, and its eccentric owner, Gene Mulvihill. I'd recommend you check this documentary out. It's a lot of fun, and it also makes you think a lot, and I had a great time watching it. I've been seeing ads for it everywhere on my social media, and I definitely think if you see an ad, sign up for HBO Max or try out the free trial and check it out. Class Action Park, it's really, really interesting, and I really enjoyed this conversation I had with Seth. And stick around for our weekly recommendations.
The story of Action Park is a true crime story.
As you entered the park, you saw this thing. And you're like, this is real.
The engineering behind this, if there was any engineering, was just nuts.
Build it higher, make it faster. People control the action.
Combine that with liquor and anything goes.
There were no rules. For a lot of kids, that was heaven.
And if you couldn't swim well, yikes.
I don't think you can understand a place like Action Park if you don't understand the kind of minds that built it.
A lot of people wish they could ignore rules. Gene actually did that. Nobody would give him insurance, so he created his own insurance company and then insured himself.
It did bring sometimes a criminal element.
I don't know how many people died at Action Park, but it wasn't just one person.
Electrocuted. Decapitated.
Fractured vertebrae.
Impaled on the bowl.
Had a heart attack.
Nobody should ever be the second person to die in a wave pool.
Close the wave pool.
Seth Porges, thanks so much for joining me today on Culturally Relevant. How are you doing today, Seth?
I'm great and so happy to be here.
Happy to be talking with you, Seth, about your career and about Class Action Park. So something I like to do at the beginning of most of my interviews on Culturally Relevant is ask about breaking in stories. You're a journalist and former editor at Popular Mechanics. Like, tell us about how you broke into the field of journalism.
Sure. I went to journalism school. I went to McGill in Northwestern and started working at magazines, which is an industry that, you know, isn't really what it used to be, unfortunately, and had a nice time there. I was mostly kind of like the gadget and technology guy at a bunch of magazines. But what's really cool about working at places like Popular Mechanics is as long as something kind of somewhat fits within what the magazine is about, you have a lot of freedom to explore topics that really interest you. So I've been actually writing about Action Park in varying capacities since 2008 or 2009, back when I was at Popular Mechanics. And I was able to kind of make the case to my editors that insane looping water slides and misinformed aspects of engineering that really drove this park were popular mechanics material. So, you know, I really enjoy being a journalist because if there's a topic that interests you, you can pursue it. You can talk to people. You can call people up, and oftentimes they'll return your calls.
I want to talk to you about your fascination with Action Park and stuff like that. But I also saw you've appeared as a commentator on a number of television shows. And I just wanted to ask you about that process. How did that begin? And also, what's something about appearing as a TV commentator that might surprise people?
Sure. When I was a magazine editor, they sort of started to throw me on TV a fair amount. I mean, this is pretty standard with big national magazines. If there's a story that is getting some attention, or if they just want to kind of throw somebody on as an expert in the general topic, if I worked at Popular Mechanics and NASA was up to something, I might kind of pop up and talk about that, for example. And I really enjoyed that. It's kind of an adrenaline rush. Live TV is a weird kind of high. It's a weird sort of thrill. But working at a place like Popular Mechanics, I began to morph from cable news and morning shows and that kind of stuff towards the nerdy stuff that's on History Channel, Discovery Channel, and National Geographic. And that's really interesting because you do one hit on a morning show and it airs and it kind of disappears. You know, nobody ever pulls it up again. Nobody ever asks you about it. Nobody ever sees it again. Very topical, very timely, and then it's gone. But when you're on a show on the History Channel, I mean, they'll play that thing again and again and again and again. And so there's stuff I taped in 2008 and 2009 that people are still sending me texts, mostly when they're watching cable in hotel rooms, which seems to be this kind of a running joke with my friends that I'm always you turn on your hotel TV and you kind of flip through the Travel Channel or Nat Geo. It's a good chance you'll bump into me.
I think there's a lot of people I know who take advantage of the fact that they know me in real life if they also listen to my podcast. Yeah. And what they'll often do is they'll listen to my podcast and then live text me their commentary/reaction on it. They're taking advantage of the fact that they know me so they can they can react to me in real time.
Sure.
It sounds like something like that is happening where people know you and they're like, oh my gosh, I just saw you on my TV, and they can just text you, which is, it can be a fun activity if you're on the, either end of that.
Yeah. Especially, some of the stuff I've done on TV isn't that kind of stuff. It's not History Channel, not Discovery. I've been on a lot of very strange kind of random TV shows over the years. So, I was on an episode of Cash Cab that, again, they air again and again and again. So, and that must have been 2006. So 10 years later, people are sending me photos of my youthful self on Cash Cab, which is a lot of fun.
Is there anything you feel like you've learned about what makes for a good quick hit TV appearance that you can share with us?
Energy. I mean, when you work at a place you work at a magazine, oftentimes some of your editors will be, really genius writers, genius editors will be put on TV, and they get really nervous. They might kind of be reciting almost mental scripts or sometimes physical scripts. And I think, what makes great TV when you have a talking head is energy and its personality. And it's sort of, a running joke with friends of mine that when the camera goes on me, I just kind of turn on and become sort of its alter ego. They call TV Seth, which is kind of funny.
Yeah. I've been making a lot of YouTube videos recently, and early on when I started making YouTube videos, I would just, I'd write down a script and I'd recite it. And then I looked at some of the early footage, and it's just wow, this is I'm so low energy, right?
Yeah.
And you really need to you need to compress all your energy and particularly the opening of the video. You need to get people's attention. I think we're all conditioned, particularly from YouTube, not necessarily from TV, to when you watch a YouTube video, the person is very energetic. They grab your attention immediately. And having seen it hundreds of times, I just kind of took for granted that that's how all YouTube videos sounded, not knowing or understanding that you need to actually put that energy in to make it happen. And of course, I'm still learning, but
sure.
I think that's a great point. Anyway, you mentioned that you've been fascinated with Action Park since 2008, 2009. And also, I believe you were involved in a short film that that eventually evolved into Class Action Park, right?
Yeah, I mean,
insane amusement park ever, I believe.
Yeah, and I've been fascinated with Action Park longer than that. That's just when I've been writing about it. I mean, I went to
fair enough.
I mean, I went to the park as a kid, and if you've ever gone to Action Park, it sticks with you, man. It's like, it doesn't leave you. I grew up going to all sorts of amusement parks. That was kind of like what our family did on vacations. We go to Disney, we go to Six Flags, we go to Busch Gardens, we go to Universal. And then on a couple occasions, we go to Action Park. And very clear from the moment you walk up to Action Park that this place is just different. You know, like the first thing you see when you walk up to Disneyland is a big castle. The first thing you see when you walk up to Action Park is a gigantic loop-the-loop water slide. And, you know, before you even enter the park, you realize, like, oh, this place is bonkers. This place is weird. And it just never leaves you, especially, you know, I went there as a young kid. And so really my impetus for kind of further exploration of the topic was the fact that I only went there a couple times. And I went there as a young kid, and I had a really kind of just hard time squaring the things I saw, the things I experienced, my memories of this place, with my concept of how reality is supposed to work. You know, like I saw these things that as you get older, you're like, did I see that? Or did I dream that? Or did I see that on a cartoon? Mm. And you just kind of, it becomes hard to really nail down what was real. And then when you start looking into Action Park, mostly what you would find would just be these urban legends and these myths. There'd be a couple like articles from Weird New Jersey, a really insane Wikipedia page, and really not much else, right? And what I realized was like, this is fascinating. I started digging into it. And unbelievably, when you start speaking to people who were there, not only are all of these legends, all of these myths, for the most part, basically true, but they're just the beginning. You know, this real story is even wilder and even weirder.
It's fascinating the way you describe it. Is like, it almost sounds like part of the reason you started exploring it was to verify whether what you remembered was actually real or not.
Exactly. Right?
Like,
yeah.
Like, because it doesn't comport with your sense of like what a proper park should be. And so it's like, did you just dream it? And apparently one of the only ways of finding out was like doing the research process you did for this film, right?
Yeah, that's a really, you're right on. I mean, when you're 6 or 7 years old and you go to say like Disneyland and you go on Indiana Jones Adventure, let's just give an example here. Part of the reason it's so effective on you as a young person is that it feels real. It feels immersive. The edge between the storytelling and reality is so, so blurry that part of you thinks you're going on this adventure or you're meeting a character. Part of you thinks that's really, you know, Winnie the Pooh, or that's really Cinderella, or whatever it is. And so at Action Park, you're kind of going into the same experience where you're not really sure where the line is between what's real and what's artifice. And, you know, you go to a ride at Disney World, Disneyland, that's a thrill ride. The thrill is this illusion. You know, you're being jerked up and down in a Tower of Terror, but you're going to be okay. But when you're 5 or 6 years old, you don't know you're going to be okay. You might be too scared to actually go on that ride because, am I actually going to be okay? What if this is the one time that we're not okay, right? And at Action Park, all of those, that thought process is present when you go there as a kid. Add to the fact that then you're actually seeing injuries and fights and violence break out around you. So you're, one part of you is saying, there's no way you can actually get hurt because this is an amusement park. And the other part of you is saying, I just saw somebody get hurt. You know, you take a ski lift to the top of this mountain to go down the alpine sled. And I just remember looking down, and it goes directly over the track for the ride. And you would just see accidents happen in real time. You'd see people crash into each other. You'd see people like stand up and take their sled off the track or get a running start and bump into somebody. And it's just, it sticks with you, man. It sticks with you.
Do you feel like this film, Class Action Park, is the culmination of your fascination? Or do you think like it's going to, your research and study will continue after this film? Like, at what point is this film coming into like your journey with this park?
Yeah. At what point am I done with Action Park?
It reminds me a little bit of, the Jinx, Robert Durst, right? That guy who like, he made the documentary, the fictional film. Then he made the documentary. Like, he's been studying that guy for years. And so I'm curious, like, yeah, how have you approached Action Park?
Yeah. So when we made that short in 2013, and I've got to shout out my collaborators on that, Anthony and Matt, That was a really amazing experience, because up until then, most of what had been out there in Action Park, again, were like a couple thinly sourced articles on a Wikipedia page. And we were actually speaking to people who were involved with the park and who basically ran the park, who were basically confirming everything we'd heard on camera. And I'd never seen anything like that. And we put it out there, and it went somewhat viral because all these people, mostly from New Jersey, who had a similar experience to me, where they'd grow up telling people these stories about Action Park, and people just kind of wouldn't believe them because they were so unbelievable. They think it's the nonsense boasts of a Jersey kid, you know, like, who believe? Oh, that's Frank. He just makes stuff up, kind of, you know. And they were passing this around as basically proof validating their childhoods. And after we put it out, I just got so many emails from people who were basically telling me something along the lines of, that's cool, but you're just scratching the surface. I got stories to tell. Mm. And so I just spent a lot of time talking to people and hearing these stories, seeing these photos, seeing the home movies they would send me, and really understanding what the bigger tapestry of the story was and what was left to be said. And that is what eventually became this feature. Now, since we put the feature out, that same thing has happened, where my inbox is being inundated with people telling me, you're just scratching the surface. I do believe that this movie is sort of the kind of final say, the culmination in terms of like documentary on the project. But I don't think I'm done on a personal level of exploring it and talking to people and trying to understand this place and the experiences of the people who went there.
So can you tell us a little bit about the process of getting this documentary financed? Like, what was it like pitching the documentary? You know, I have seen very few documentaries about theme parks, just in general. So I assume it might have been challenging to get people to back this, but I don't know. So how did it come about?
Well, without going into too much detail, this is a totally self-produced movie. You know, if you actually... watch it. It wasn't, you know, it's archival and talking head and some animation. It was a self-produced movie. You know, I had met with people and kind of pitched it, the story in different facets, but you kind of run into this obstacle, which was that a scripted film had come out a couple years earlier called Action Point that didn't really do particularly well, that was somewhat loosely based on the Action Park topic. And
narrative fiction film starring Johnny Knoxville that was based on the park, right?
Yes. Yeah. And the way things tend to work in Hollywood is, if you know, you have one data point and it doesn't do well, people just kind of assume a topic is toxic. You know, like, oh, people don't like movies about this because that one didn't do well. And of course, it's a very different story, just very, very different. And it was very loosely inspired by. And also, I think the Action Park topic itself, because it's so outrageous and so weird and so wild, it really, I think, works really well as a documentary. Because you can see anything on camera as a scripted film and, you know, you're like, that's cool, but it doesn't make you go, how the heck was that real? Because you know it's not real. And I think when you have something that's so unbelievable, you just have to treat it straight. You have to treat it with journalism. You have to treat it like a documentary. And I think that's why the response has been what it's been.
You are the co-director on Class Action Park, along with filmmaker Chris Charles Scott. Can you tell us about how you shared co-director duties? Do you both do everything? Did you do some things and he did other things? Like, how do you co-direct a documentary like this?
Chris is my best friend and my partner in crime on this, so he deserves all the accolades, all the hugs, all the love here. So for this project here, you know, the way we sort of approached it was, I was the person who'd been living in the Action Park world for, you know, a decade or so. I had the sources, I knew the story, I had the research, but I didn't know how to really make a movie, you know? And Chris is my friend who knows how to make a movie. And he brought in such an interesting perspective because he was the outsider. He had barely heard of Action Park before. So, you know, it's a forest through the trees scenario. I've been living in this world for so long that there's a chance I would have really lost sight about why this story is important or what about it might resonate to people, particularly people who have never heard of Action Park like Chris. And I think a lot of what you see in the movie that has really struck a chord to people, it's all Chris. It's all Chris. Without him, the movie would have been, I think, a very dry, straight, factual recounting of the story of Action Park. But what he realized, I think that's so important to how the movie works the way it does, is that even if you didn't grow up going to the Action Park, you might have, if you were a kid from the 80s, grown up going to an Action Park, whether that was an abandoned quarry or some rusty factory or the local cliffs that, you know, some kid dove off and got hurt on. You know, every town, every community in this 1980s era of latchkey kids running around without parental supervision, people were doing all sorts of stupid, crazy things. Difference from Action Park and all that, though, is that it was a gated amusement park where you pay for the pleasure.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I really enjoyed about the documentary is that I think documentaries are at their best when they be you think they're about a specific topic, but then their scope widens to be about something broader than that. And I think, you know, one of the themes of Class Action Park is the idea that, like, this generation that went to Action Park was the last generation that will ever be raised like that, right?
Yes.
Which is to say, no cell phones, you know, like you can't keep track of where your kids are. And I mean, I grew up in the 80s. It's easy to forget that back then you'd say like, hey, mom, going over to my friend's house. And then you just leave for 8 hours and they have no idea of like what happened to you. You know, did something go wrong on the way to your friend's house? Like they just don't know. And yeah. Parents lived with that uncertainty, kids lived with that uncertainty, and this park was almost like a physical manifestation of that uncertainty, right? The idea that like anything bad could happen to you. So did you kind of like realize that as like a theme early on? Did it come together in the edit? Was it something that your colleague Chris Charles Scott brought to it? Like, curious about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, that came to us very, very early. I mean, before we ever rolled cameras, you know, Chris and I would just basically get some drinks and talk about Action Park and try to unravel it and what it means, you know. And that, you know, really came to us really early, especially because, you know, the same people who grew up going to Action Park growing up in the 80s, you ask them, like, would you let your kids grow up that way? And they just say, hell no. And one of the things that interests us so much was how yesteryear's latchkey kids are today's helicopter parents and trying to understand that. So there's this one scene in the movie where we talked to a guy who worked at the park, but prior to working there, he was just a local teenager who would ride his bike 15 miles to go to Action Park and then back the same day. And his parents had no idea that that's what he was doing. And he basically says, if my kid tried to do that, I would beat his ass. And I think that's so, so, so telling. And I think that's eventually what the movie really becomes about, in doing no small part to the absolutely genius commentary given to us by comedian Chris Gethard, this idea that we look back at our childhoods, we can look back at them and be grateful for these experiences we had. We can be thankful that we were able to have this freedom and this fun, but at the same time, know that something about it was absolutely, totally messed up. And those two feelings can absolutely coexist with each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The idea that the latchkey kids are now the helicopter parents, that's fascinating. I think like part of it comes from the fact that like if you were a latchkey kid, you understand the danger that you could get up to or
you
got up
to. You shake your head with a sense of astonishment that you're still alive, you know? Like everybody who went to Action Park or, you know, grew up in some other place and had their own sorts of experiences like Action Park, one of the most common responses is, how are we still alive, man? How are we still alive? Like they know, and they had a good time. They're grateful for this, but they feel the sense of some degree like survivor's guilt. Because everybody has that friend who didn't make it, you know? Like, I know people who, just by virtue of running around playing outdoors, like, got killed as kids. Like, this happened, man. This happened. And I think that that is such an interesting, interesting idea that I really don't think I've seen explored much.
It's also, you know, this is a complete, like, tangent that we don't need to go down, but I think it's also, like, it's interesting to see how society's opinion or attitude towards children has evolved over the years, because, you know, hundreds of years ago you'd have many, many kids, and it's just very possible that one of them would die, right? And people just accept, obviously it was very tragic and heartbreaking, but like it was kind of regularly accepted as like, oh, that's a thing that happened. Whereas now I think people are having people have fewer kids, right? And so I almost feel like that shifts the burden of care, right? Like the used to be distributed amongst a huge family. Now, like, you only have one or two kids. Most people only have one or two kids. And it's like, and it kind of impacts how they might parent those kids.
Absolutely. It's, I mean, like sort of, I mean, that's where the term like eggs in a basket comes from with birds, you know, it really is that.
So John Hodgman narrates this documentary.
Yes.
He does a great job. Were you involved in the decision to A, have voiceover, or B, choose John Hodgman?
I needed to have John Hodgman do it. Yes, I was very closely involved with that decision. I had heard that John Hodgman had gone to Action Park. And the minute I heard that, I knew he was our guy. He was the person we needed. I'm a huge fan of his work. I love his voice. You know, I mean, the stuff he does on radio and whatnot. It's just so interesting how he's able to convey both intelligence and humor at the same time, how he's able to be funny but serious. And, you know, that balance is so important for this movie, because it's a movie that is in some parts very funny and in some parts very tragic. And I needed somebody who could walk that line and kind of guide the audience between those conflicting emotions. And those conflicting emotions occur very, very quickly, very quickly. And that's by design. You know, like, we wanted people to laugh and then immediately feel very uncomfortable and perhaps hate themselves for laughing. And John Hodgman, as a tool for us to accomplish that, he was our guy.
What was behind the decision to have voiceover in the first place? I'm curious, like, because there's many documentaries. You could have done this with no voiceover. I think it works really well with voiceover. But curious, like, what was behind that call?
Sure. So there's a lot of kind of nuts and bolts, factual information we needed to convey, exposition, we'll call it. And, you know, if we had just had the talking heads sort of say this information, I think it would have been a little disingenuous, especially, you know, I'm a talking head in this movie. And it's really funny hearing some people say, like, the director doesn't disclose he's a talking head. Well, you know, we have famous comedians who are labeled as park guests in this movie. Like, everything is sort of by design, kind of abstract and, you know, immersive in the film's world. You know, so I'm a journalist. We have a couple other journalists in the film. These journalists are familiar with the story, but there's an efficiency in storytelling that a narrator brings to the table. There's sort of a rhythm that a narrator brings. And it was really clear, kind of an early cuts of the movie before we had a narrator, that there were just moments where we needed one, where there's moments where this movie was okay without it, but it would have been great with it. And Hodgman, again, and I wanted somebody who had personal experience with Action Park, which Hodgman had. And I wanted somebody who, again, could sort of guide us through these conflicting emotions, which I think he did a great job of doing.
I realize we've gotten to this point in the conversation. We haven't really summarized kind of some of the greatest hits from Action Park
Sure. In
terms of why it was so dangerous. You know, if people are still listening to this conversation, they might be wondering, like, what was the big deal with this place? So can you give us like a couple of highlights, things that stuck out to you about why this place might be so frightening and fascinating?
Yeah. So in a macro sense, when I zoom out, we're just talking about this insane amusement park. It was one of the very first water parks built in the entire country, likely, you know, depending on how you count, the third after Wet n Wild and Schlitterbahn, depending if you count Disney's River Country. And it was really one of the first of its kind. And up until this point, nobody really knew what a water park was. So they literally had to invent this in real time. There was no template. There was no, I'm going to an amusement industry like IAPA, like a trade show, and just buying a bunch of water slides and building a water park. They had to invent it. And so a lot of these rides, just by virtue of that, were extremely experimental. And mix that in with just this 80s sense of laissez-faire deregulation, mixed in with the fact that the park was run almost entirely by children, 14, 15, 16-year-olds, mix in the fact that the people who went to the park were aware of its reputation, and instead of avoiding it, leaned into it. They would go, not despite the fact people thought it was dangerous, but because they knew it was dangerous, and then they would try to have the most dangerous and chaotic experience possible. All of those factors mixed together is just, you know, it's a perfect storm of calamity.
Yeah. And basically, there were rides that were on the face of it dangerous and that were likely to cause injury and occasionally death, right? Like, it was very poorly supervised. It was not safe at all. And that's one of the most fascinating things is, like, you realize when you go to a theme park, and this is a point made very well in the documentary, that it's about the artifice of danger. And you go because you think, I might die, but deep down, you know you won't.
Yes.
Because obviously a million people have been on this ride before, and there's a $1 billion company backing this. But then the difference at Action Park was, no, you actually could get seriously, grievously injured on these rides.
Yeah, Action Park was a series of extreme sports masquerading as an amusement park. The owner was very conscious in terms of how he would describe the ride. He didn't view it as an amusement park or theme park. He viewed it as something he called a self-participation park. And the idea being that he wanted to take...
A self-actualization park.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the park was built adjacent to a ski resort. It was sort of an off-season attraction trying to monetize a ski resort throughout the whole year, because in New Jersey, the ski season is very short. And he wanted to take the idea from a ski resort where this is an inherently dangerous activity, but you take on an assumption of risk by participating in it. You know, if you get hurt skiing, it's very difficult to sue the ski resort because everybody knows skiing can be dangerous. So he wanted to take that idea. And so he would describe his park as being something much closer to a warm weather ski resort, where these arrives where you were in control just like you would be when you were skiing. The problem was that, you know, again, the amusement park of it all is a narcotic that lulls people into a sense of complacency. Because when you walk up to an amusement park, you think that the thrill is storytelling and that you can't be hurt. At Action Park, you know, you were doing activities here that actually were dangerous, that you had a lot of control with how you would go through the experience. And if you treated it like a roller coaster where you have, you know, it's all thrill, I'm not going to get hurt. You actually could get hurt. And on top of that, it wasn't just, you know, if you tried to get hurt, you get hurt. A lot of the rides are poorly designed, so people who did nothing wrong got hurt, or you're sharing space with people who might be doing everything wrong and bump into you or crash into you.
So about, I'd say, 2/3 of the documentary is people reflecting on what a kick-ass, amazing time they had at Action Park. But one of the things the documentary does is profile people or talk about how the park had a darker side as well, you know, and people actually died at this park. And the owner and creator of the park, Gene Mulvihill, was quite cold. He was not a very sympathetic person when it came to these types of things. And so I guess I'm curious. It sounds like this is very important for you to include this. So talk about like why that was important, and also how you went about balancing these tones from like, whoa, it's super fun, dude, to like, now yeah, this is extremely serious and upsetting.
Absolutely. We wanted to make that shift from fun and games to the tragedy as absolutely abrupt as possible. If you go to a place like Action Park, up until the minute you get hurt, you might be having the best time of your life. There's no telegraphing. There's no warning. You know, real life has that tonal shift where it comes out of nowhere and it hits you like an alpine slide cart. And we wanted to simulate that, especially because up until now, most of what's been out there about Action Park, including things that I myself have written or put out there about Action Park, very much leans into the myth of it all, the urban legend of all, the idea that this was this fun, incredible, no rules place. Wouldn't it be great if we could have that? And I think it's okay to some degree for people to be nostalgic for things like that, but they need to know the full story. So we wanted to make a movie that would make you laugh and then make you feel very, very, very uncomfortable for laughing. And it's been really amazing reading the responses, because I think some people get that. Then some people think that that sense of discomfort is a bug and not a feature. We wanted to make you feel uncomfortable. We wanted to make you question your own laughter. We didn't want to make a movie that the beats are telegraphed, that you feel like, oh, I know where this is going to go. We wanted to make a movie where you are smiling and laughing, and then a minute later, that smile is gone, and you're filled with self-doubt as a result.
Well, I think you definitely achieve that. I mean, I think the thing that I reflect on when I look at movies like Class Action Park is like, do these movies end up still in some ways mythologizing these people that like in this case, Gene Mulvihill, who helped create Action Park, like do they end up contributing to the mythology in a way that is like
unhealthy for our society, you know, because like Wolf of Wall Street style, you know, Wolf of Wall Street obviously has a perspective that like that character is not savory. At the same time, it makes that character so intoxicating, you know, that
like any mob movie. Yeah. Like every mob
right.
movie, like everyone wants to be Scarface, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So do you ever worry about that as you were making the movie? Like maybe we're making Gene out to be like too exciting of a guy, you know, like curious if you had any feelings about that.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad you asked that because reading people's responses to the movie, there's people who walk away saying what an absolute scumbag villain he was. And there's other people who say what a scumbag villain he was, but they kind of pump him up a little. And really it's like that. No, we're not. We are telling you who this guy was. We're not having some dour voiceover tell you what to think about him. He was a complex person. Even the people who hated him had, you know, more complex thoughts with him because he was such an intricate part of the community. A lot of people commented on how one of our characters, who's a newspaper editor, who had a very contentious relationship with Gene for many years, towards the end of his life, they actually became friends. And I thought that was actually really, people got upset that we included that because they thought it was some sort of redemption arc for Gene. And that wasn't it at all. Literally, when we talked to Jesse, this person, she told us very honestly everything she did not like about Gene, but she said he's more complex than that. And I'm really glad we put that in because that's her story. You know, we're not trying to tell you what to think. I think the fact that people walk away from this movie feeling like this is a really bad guy, but the filmmakers maybe don't make him feel bad, I think tells us that you probably walked away from this movie feeling like he was a bad guy because of things in this movie. You know, like where, you know, it's not like you're walking away thinking he was a good guy if that's what you feel. So, you know, I do believe that the worst amongst us are humans. And I think that turning people into cartoon cutout monsters only furthers a lot of problems out there. It alienates people. It alienates people. And, you know, we all know horrible people. We've all done horrible things ourselves, but we're humans. And Action Park, likewise, Action Park itself was a place of immense tragedy, a place of immense sadness. But at the same time, it was a place that some people look back at very fondly. And I think it's important to not just suddenly turn into a documentary where Morgan Freeman is telling you what to think. You know, we're not here to tell you what to think. But it sounds like the fact, you know, the response has been, I think, kind of inception-y, you know, like we're not telling you what to think, but people are kind of walking away with the right idea.
You have talked about the response to the movie. And I think a part of that is that it is on HBO Max, which is like a big streaming platform. Like how did that distribution come about? Cause that's like a pretty big get, right?
Yeah. I mean, the HBO Max people have been just the best. And I mean, it's so easy for somebody to be like, oh yeah, like thanks corporate partner. But like, seriously, you know, this is a challenging movie. It's a movie that I think a lot of people would have wanted to just be the first hour, just really fun and exciting. And I think some people would have wanted to be just the last half hour, kind of, you know, a more serious, introspective deconstruction and takedown of the place. And it's neither and it's both. And the friction, that tension, that sense of discomfort that comes from both those elements rubbing up against each other is what this movie is to us. And HBO Max understood that, and they didn't try to push us away from that. And I can imagine another partner really trying to push us away from that. And I'm grateful that they kind of gave us that creative freedom.
But how did like the distribution deal come about, I guess? Because, you know, for many documentaries, right, the path they take is debut at a film festival and then get picked up for distribution. Like, what was the path that Class Action Park took?
Yeah, our initial plan was something along those lines. You know, we were all set to play at a number of film festivals. They all got canceled due to COVID. So we were, you know, just very lucky to kind of have the opportunity to talk with and meet with HBO Max, and they understood what we were doing. It's really that simple. You know, the movie had gotten a fair amount of attention before it played anywhere, before it was even finished. Because the topic of Action Park, there's something about it that I think excites the imagination and people are somewhat obsessed with. And, you know, so we put a trailer out that actually led to a feature in the New York Times. And so we weren't like a hidden under the radar movie even then, before we had been picked up by anybody.
You've talked about some of the reactions that you've gotten to it. Is there one misconception or one reaction that you feel like you wish you could respond to now that the movie's out?
Yeah, I think honestly, you know, yes, I think I mentioned this before, but I think people watch this movie and they don't understand that the sense of discomfort they're feeling was by design. You know, I think a lot of people want to feel more comfortable, and they don't understand that that weird, skizzy feeling they're feeling, that sense of self-doubt, that sense of self-hatred for laughing 20 minutes prior was entirely by design, absolutely by design. And it was our goal was to make people laugh and then make them question their own laughter. And again, like that structure that we're going to give you a really fun, hilarious kind of comedy movie and then immediately take a dark turn is what life is like if you get injured at a place like Action Park. And that was entirely the design.
Seth Porges is a science and technology journalist and a former editor at Popular Mechanics. He's also the co-director of Class Action Park, which is out right now on HBO Max. Seth Porges, thanks so much for joining us today on Culturally Relevant.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Welcome to Weekly Recommendations. This is the part of the show each week where I recommend something I've been listening to, watching, reading, smelling, etc. I had a chance to ask Seth Porges what he recommends this week. Here's what he had to say.
You know what? I'll give a shout out to a podcast I really like that might be of interest to people who like Action Park related stuff. I think if people are interested in theme parks and like laughing, they should check out the podcast The Ride, which is just an amazing comedy theme park podcast.
Podcast The Ride. A comedy theme park podcast. Thanks for the recommendation, Seth. Huge thanks to Seth for sitting down with me and sharing his thoughts about his documentary as well as his weekly recommendation. This week, I want to recommend a movie and an accompanying video essay. I had a chance to watch Charlie Kaufman's new movie, I'm Thinking of Ending Things, and I haven't put together like a really in-depth research video essay in quite a while, but I was so fascinated by this documentary. I found it so thought-provoking, so evocative, as with much of Charlie Kaufman's work, that I spent many hours to put together a video essay explaining what exactly is going on in this movie. So I really appreciate all of my patrons for making a video essay like this possible. And again, you can always support me by going to patreon.com/DaveChen. People who are supporting me there are also supporting this podcast. But yeah, check out my newest video essay about Charlie Kaufman's I'm Thinking of Ending Things. Of course, make sure you watch the movie on Netflix first. But yeah, it's really, really great, really powerful, and really deeply sad and depressing. The movie, of course, not the video essay. Maybe you'll find both depressing, but I think the video essay is actually was fun to make. It just took a while. So hope you have a chance to check that out. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Culturally Relevant. You can find more episodes of the show at culturallyrelevantshow.com. Email us at culturallyrelevantshow@gmail.com and follow this podcast on Twitter at CrevShow, CrevShow. This episode was edited and produced by me, David Chen, and it was powered by Simplecast. Check out simplecast.com for great podcast management and analytics solution. They're awesome. Simplecast.com. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Culturally Relevant. We'll see you next week.